All right, today I'm sitting down with Devin O'Donohue for the Grayscale Podcast. Devin, welcome.
Oh, thanks, man. I'm glad to be here, you know, having a good time, you know, eating my Panda Express while we're doing this. All right, what's good?
Wavy. All right, so today what we're going to talk about today, focusing on is immigration policies regarding South America and Mexico, and just sort of get our opinions on it. So first, what do you think of the current state of immigration?
I think our current state of immigration is not that bad, to be honest. I feel like it's all right. It could use somewhat improving, but I'm not entirely sure where, because I don't really deal with immigration like that. So I mean, my opinion is going to be a little biased.
Well, that's what founders getting your thoughts out today.
All right, so it's going to sound a little ignorant if I say a couple of wrong things.
No, you're fine. So how do you feel about Trump's more recent proposals for immigration? After your visit to California this past weekend to get prospects for a border wall, what's your opinion on sort of a physical barrier between the United States and Mexico?
I honestly don't feel like it's going to work because, I mean, we already have a long fence that's supposed to stop people, and that don't really do shit.
Well, right now, only about 20% of the border is actually covered with fence. But going back to what you were saying just now, I personally don't think the wall would work per se, mainly because New York Times reported that over 60% of illegal immigration came from overstaying visit visas. Mm. Basically, they'd get a visa to come into the country and then not go back. Mm. So, sort of gauging on that policy, how do you feel would be the best or means of attack for that, given that you think immigration's a problem?
I feel it's a problem, but it's not at the same time, because, of course, people are coming in illegally and just overstaying. I don't want to say overstaying their welcome, which technically they are.
No, but it's a traffic visa, so I mean, it wouldn't be wrong to say.
So, I mean, I feel like they need to, because of course there's a certain process of how you go through becoming becoming a legal citizen of the United States. Like, I feel like, because I don't think they should just, like, grab them all up, you know, deport them and all that shit. That's just a lot of work. And that's, like, really expensive. Like, yeah. You probably spend more money trying to send them, like, over there and building this wall to keep them out when, either way, they probably just get back in regardless. I feel like we need to, like, just think of better ways to help them move through the system smoothly so they can just, you know, be assimilated into American culture and shit like that.
Yeah, I'm glad you said the word assimilation. A lot of times when we have immigration talks, they sort of center around different cultures and countries. Mm. So a major problem a lot of people see on different sides is if groups are willing to sort of integrate into American culture, well, it's going to be a blended culture type of thing. Do you believe that we should have more? Do you think it's fine to have that blended culture, or do you think we should assimilate or put immigrants on a path to assimilate American values in a way?
I feel like they should, like, I feel like it should be a mixture of both, because understand they're coming to America for a reason. They're coming for the American experience. They're coming to have, like, they're coming to understand our values, our way of life, and how we live in. Because I feel like they should learn the way, like, we are and the things we do. But at the same time, they're bringing their culture, they're bringing their heritage to America to help us learn about them and who they are as a people, like their family, where they're from, this, that, their background, this, that, and the third. And that's what makes America America, because we're a mixture of multiple racist people, yes, and so on and so forth. So, like, to say really assimilate them, honestly, at the same time, isn't the correct word, because they're America's a mixture. Yeah. You're just adding to the mix.
Well, let me go ahead and jump in right here. So you're talking about the American culture of assimilation. So it's pretty common that America, the language we speak in America is English predominantly over any other language.
Correct.
Now, one thing that got a lot of flack, a lot of hay was raised when Trump announced his immigration policy for HB1 visas, was favoring migrants that spoke English. Now, a lot of people saw that as a sort of discriminatory targeted stipulation to his immigration policy, because he would more favor people from a Nordic country or from the United Kingdom, Australia's English-speaking countries. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's a discriminatory policy in favoring applicants that would speak English? Because I personally do believe that would sort of streamline the assimilation process into American society.
I feel like it's discriminatory, but at the same time, I see what he's saying because it is a predominantly English-speaking country, but at the same time, like I said, it's a mixing pot. There's a whole lot of different languages in America, so you can't just...
Well, about 80%, according to Wall Street, speak English. Mm-hmm. So that's far and away the dominant language. There's no close second to that. Mm-hmm. But Spanish would be a close second with that about 15% of the population speaking it. Mm-hmm. And even that 15% still encompasses English speakers.
Even 15% is still a lot of people. And what's it called? To say you're looking for English speakers... A lot of people around.
Not solely English speakers, but they would get favored in the application process if they had the ability to. So it wouldn't be a be-all, end-all. If you don't speak English, you wouldn't be accepted. But just favoring applicants that do, because like you were saying, the assimilation into culture and society, that's kind of a common language, is a big part of a society. So do you think it's wrong to sort of favor those applicants over the other?
I feel like it's wrong, but I don't feel like it's wrong at the same time because it would speed up their process if you already know English. That way you can communicate with more people, you can do more things, you don't have to struggle in trying to figure out what you need to do when you're in America. So it's easier for you to, you know, proceed through, you know, like the American dream to get there if you're around, because if you're in a country where they predominantly speak English, it's better for you to know English so you can, like, you know, interact with multiple people and get your point across of what you're trying to do. However, around the world, they're taught, they have their first language, but they're also, the majority of the world is taught English at a young age. So a lot of people around the world already know English. Yeah. They don't know it fluently because it's not their first language, but they know English. They know the basics.
Yeah.
So to say that you're only looking for English speakers, then
not only, but
a lot of the world isn't cut off like that.
Yes.
But I feel like that's discriminatory because it's primarily aimed towards the South, like the South, Southern Hemisphere, like Brazil, Colombia, Nicaragua, stuff like that, where they predominantly only speak Spanish or they speak Portuguese or they speak an older language or something like that. I feel like that's discriminatory just for them, whereas the rest of the world, they're mostly taught English at a young age, like Japan, Germany, and stuff like that.
More westernized countries.
Yeah, they're taught English.
So going back to what we're going to backtrack a little here, when you're talking about overstaying H-1B visas, travel visas, one of the proposals in Trump's recent immigration plan was to provide amnesty for 1.8 million people. Mm-hmm. Now, do you believe that, you know, since these people technically did circumvent the system, they did overstay and break federal immigration law, do you feel like it's right in a way to give those people amnesty for being in here and still have the same immigration process, or how do you feel like we should handle the process of amnesty for people who are overstayed or are in this country legally?
I feel like they should be given amnesty because they're...
Wouldn't that be sort of rewarding for circumventing a system a little bit? You came and just happened to be at the right time where they give amnesty to people who are in?
It makes sense, but you can't... You can't just, all the people you deported, you can't just go back and find all those people and then decide to give them amnesty. Like, that would take entirely too much time. Like, the people that are here now, you give them amnesty if they've been working and providing, like, you know, helping the system, they're helping the American, like, all of us as a total. I feel like they deserve amnesty if they've been working, if they've been contributing. That's fine. They're just trying to make a living for themselves, and they're also trying to better all the rest of us by making the country look better because they're working. I feel like they deserve amnesty for that. Well, if they work for it.
Well, something about helping the system is a lot of times, you know, for undocumented workers, a lot of times payroll taxes are a bit of a sticky issue because you really can't verify income accurately with a lot of those workers. So if you're saying paying into a system, how would we go about sort of figuring out a system where we've realized who has been paying into a system and who hasn't been pulling out? Because in a lot of places like California, you don't even need to prove identification to receive state benefits. You can receive social benefits from the state without a social security card, address. Mm-hmm. So how would we go about sort of cracking down on social security fraud and different entitlement programs for people who are undocumented workers?
Then I feel like they just need to, when it comes to the businesses, I feel like they need to keep track of their workers and give, you know, now I don't want to say daily checks, they just have updated information for who's getting what, who's doing what, and so on.
What's wrong with a lot of that for a lot of workers is, like on the DACA registry, only about, the number that Trump proposed was 1.8 million, but only about 600,000 or so are on the DACA registry. A lot of workers don't want that information being kept for the sole reason of if they do start to crack down on immigration for deportations, they would know exactly where to go. Mm-hmm. That's why a lot of people don't sign the DACA registry. That's mm-hmm. definitely a big problem for that system.
Then it's gonna kind of go back and forth then, because you don't want them. No pressure. They don't want to sign up, but at the same time, they don't want to sign up because that means they can just go find them and ship them away.
Yeah, that's a fear a lot of people have for undocumented workers is verification of location.
But at the same time, if they do that and you figure out how much like they're contributing and this, that, and the third, and you just don't feel like it's enough, you can just get rid of them whenever you want. That's kind of not fair. I feel like every person they've been working, they deserve the amnesty if you work towards it. Because they're not here just, you know, sitting around. They ain't coming just doing nothing. If they're actually like working, then I feel like they deserve that amnesty because they're just trying to make a living for themselves. They're trying to make a better living than they would in Mexico, because Mexico is not the best place to be right now. In fact, it's terrible to be right now. They're just trying to move on and find a better life for them and their family. I feel like,
yes.
And granted, trying to get in the country through the actual process itself is actually very hard. And at the same time, it's very expensive.
But as a country, do you feel like as a sovereign country, you know, you choose who to invite into your house? You know, I can't walk into your house while you're not there and then
correct.
Decide to sleep on your couch and no correct. Demand to give me things.
You have to work.
Yes. But at the same time, do you believe that while I'd be there, you have the right to allow whoever you want into your house? So as a country, why would it be sort of wrong if we had a... Even if the system is difficult, why is that wrong for a country to have a difficult system of immigration if we're trying to weed out the best applicants?
I'm not saying it's wrong to have it difficult, because yes, you're trying to weed out the people that are bad and who's good and who's this and the third. Who's best for us as a whole? So I understand that part. I understand that aspect. But at the same time, they may be in a bad situation that they're just trying to get away from. They might not necessarily be a bad person or a bad candidate. They just come from a bad
area. Yeah. But with that same point, like we were saying with the amnesty for people who have circumvented the system, do you think that's still, in a way, I guess, equitable or fair to the people who have stayed in that bad situation, have attempted to go through the legal immigration process, have taken up to 10 years?
Mm-hmm.
Rather than someone who came overstayed HB1 and then is given amnesty, is that fair to the other applicants in line, or how would you go about making a more equitable system?
That's a hard ass question. I feel that giving the amnesty to those people, a lot of those are women and children.
About a third, and that's also, that goes into another topic that I don't think we're going to get it and going to be able to get to, is the difference between an immigrant and an economic migrant.
Because
immigrants, you would assume they would, if you're a refugee status or immigration, be coming to a sanctuary, you'd get asylum, and then be going back. Economic migrants would be, you know, coming to the country to establish a economic base, a founding, and with no plans to return.
Mm-hmm.
So that would cause a divide with those. And a lot of times economic migrants are predominantly male. So largely they've had households going out and setting up living situations to come back to.
Alright, so back to the amnesty thing. If, say he gives 1.8 million people amnesty, you think it wouldn't be good because a lot of them are here illegally, whereas some people have been going through the process.
I feel like it wouldn't. Gone through. I feel like it wouldn't be equitable.
If that's the case.
But I mean, if you went through... If you had to apply to a college and you have to work for 9-10 years to get the grades, go into that school, be accepted to your programs, and then one day I come onto campus and I start taking all the classes under the radar for an amount of time, and then once they realize I'm there, they admit me into the program for simply circumventing the application system. So that wouldn't be equitable.
I can understand how that's unfair. But if that's the case, then why not, instead of giving amnesty for 1.8 million people, why not just let the next 1.8 million people that go through the process just let them in?
No, because
that's essentially the same thing.
Well, I mean, you're talking about a large spike in immigration at that point. That could, I mean, I don't think we have to go into the topics of how that would change closer dramatically in a spike. I mean, if you
because that's,
if you accept about 4.2 million people overnight, you can imagine the detriment that would have on many social programs, many communities, many.
Because at that point, I feel like you just give 1.8 million people amnesty. Like, you're just giving the whole group amnesty. If you let the next 1.8 million people in, that's just, at that point, that's just first come, first serve.
Yeah, which was the same program that I was saying was inequitable. So people who sort of overstayed got here first. In a fair system, adjudicate them first? Or how would we go about being responsible in that system?
You have to work back and forth with that. Because if you get 1.8 million people amnesty, that means the other people, you have to work some in while they're working others out. Or take these people and put them in the process.
Yes.
Just put them back into the process. You're already getting amnesty, but we're going to put you through the process so you are documented at that point.
Yeah.
I don't want to say put them in the back of the line because they've obviously been working. Others have been working. They've just been in the process working while others have also been working like from the bottom up.
Yeah. But no, that same system,
Do half and half. If you want to be completely fair about it, do half and half.
Now, one of the major problems that people run into when announcing policies like this, blanket amnesty policies, is usually those policies are set for deadlines well in advance. Those are about a year out deadlines. One of the problems that you run into with announcing programs like that is you usually see a surge of people coming in because it's a thought of, if I get in by this date, I'll be provided a sense of amnesty. Which is why I'm honestly not completely for the idea of amnesty for already, don't want to say socialized, but already arrived.
What would you prefer?
This actually comes into a difficult, this is where we sort of hit a wall on this, is we have to figure out a way to first get documentation of who is here, which is a minefield in its own. Because like I said, it's reported less than half of the DACA registry is who is undocumented in this country. So one of the things that would probably be a problem with, we probably have to, no matter what, I feel like we're going to have to start with them. We're going to have to start with deportations. Because I feel like all plans would have to start there if we're going to make, just for the point of equity and fairness in the system, I feel like that would be the first step in any immigration proposal that we have to face.
So you want to deport all, or just the males of the household?
We can't really scream it that way because that would run into economic migrants and immigrants. But I feel like, yes, we have to first have a step where we reset the program, where we have to work from a blank slate in a way, just for systems of equity and fairness. Because, like I said, it doesn't ring fair as I've overstayed and I've come here for 5 years versus someone who's still living in Guadalajara and has been in the immigration process for 7. If the person who's already here gets amnesty and they don't, that doesn't really make for an equitable or just system.
So, you're saying, okay, so you're saying deport the males now, so you're saying just deport all of them?
I feel like we need either 100% documentation and verification is here, because I feel like we need to start immigration from a blank slate. I feel like we need to start from a zero-sum game to be able to better assess who's coming in for purposes of fairness in the system.
You would ask all those people to step up and become documented or be put on the books, and then what? Then would you like to do? I'm trying to ask you the step-by-step process.
Then
they all step up. Let's just say they all step up and they all become documented.
Yeah. I feel like at that point we have to not take into account how long they've been here, just in purposes of fairness.
Okay.
I wouldn't say deport me. I feel like at that point, once we have documentations, we can file through on a case-to-case basis of our regular immigration system. You know, see attributes, see traits, see different skills that can be brought in. But I feel like as soon as you start considering amount of time already spent here, you're favoring people who have circumvented a system over people who have stayed in the system properly.
And at the same time, you don't want to send.
But that goes into the same problem is there's a lot of people who, you can say rightfully so, don't trust going on registries. They don't want to be documented, verified of a specific location. They don't want the federal government to have an address for them. So that would be a big problem leading into that solution.
But what are some of the people going to do if the breadwinner gets split up from the family? Because at that point, let's just say you're keeping some of them, but if you take away the majority of the breadwinners, you just put a lot of people in poverty that you have to now deal with.
Well, a lot of that's sort of also around the idea of chain migration. I'm assuming you're familiar with that. Is where a lot of times when people do immigrate to the country, their direct family, children, spouses, and parents are able to gain preferential treatment through the system.
Okay.
Because when the chain migration rule came, that was to allow families to be together. But a lot of times what we've seen now with the chain migration rule is uncles and cousins and nieces and nephews and further out from extended family are now getting preferential treatment through a system of chain migration.
Okay.
So I'd be for a system that if you go through the process, we do partially fit, and you get accepted through the process, of course, if you are admitted. I am for a stipulation where we do allow for direct family members, children and parents.
So you want a limit? So you want a limit?
Yeah, at a certain point, there has to be a limit, because, I mean, we can't just have complete open borders.
I understand, you can't bring the entire family in.
Yeah. So just direct descendants to help assimilation and structure into the country.
Now, you're going to have some cases where people, they argue that the extended family member that they're trying to bring is all they have. But that, they're the only one left on that side of the family. They're just alone.
Would
it be exceptions? Would it be a case-by-case thing to where they get accepted? It's just, like, let's say one or two extra people.
I feel like this is one of those things we would have to make a hard rule on. I feel like this is one of the things we would have to be firm in stating direct family members. Because as soon as you start making exceptions, that leads for an entire...
Because what if they say, who would you define as a direct family member? Just father and mother, mother, father, grandmother?
So let's say for you, mm-hmm. Your wife, mm-hmm. your children, mm-hmm. your parents, mm-hmm. brother and sister. Mm-hmm. But when you start going into uncles, great, anythings,
well,
nieces and nephews.
What if they... Okay. Let's just make this case. Let's say it's my family, right?
Yes.
And you said my parents. So
your parents,
so
your children.
So my children's grandparents, all right?
Yeah.
So let's say my brother didn't get accepted, but his kids are like one or two. Would you not make an exception just for the kids to come?
No, I feel like that's what I was saying. We have to make a hard rule where those would be your nieces and nephews, mm-hmm. if I'm correct. I feel like we have to make a hard rule at some point where it's direct lineage.
Now,
so if your brother would get preferential treatment, under that same logic though, mm-hmm. if he got admitted under that system, his children would be able to receive that same preferential treatment that your children would be able to receive.
Now, what if we go into a family where I get accepted, but those same children are taken care of by their grandmother? So you said I'll get accepted, my kids will get accepted, and my parents.
And your spouse.
Now, my grandparents, they also take care of kids. Do they get to come too?
No, I feel like we'd have to make a hard cutoff at direct. That direct family, if we're going to have a system that's under control and tamed. Mm-hmm. So I feel like, again, when you start getting to that rule, you start opening the floodgates for far away distant relatives to be able to fall under that umbrella.
Because at that point, I feel... Because some people are taken care of by their grandparents.
Yes. And also, just to address, a 1 and 2 year old would not be able to apply by themselves. They would have to have a sponsor of a direct parent.
I feel like you should make an age limit. There's an extended person's limit. How far you go to the extended family. Like you say, you want a direct family. But I feel you should make a certain number, let's just say 3 or 2, if they're under a certain age of, like, you know, 3 or 1, then they don't even remember living where they were.
Yeah, that's a lot of issues that come up with DACA proposals. A lot of the children that came to the DACA program were here when they were 5 or 6. Mm-hmm. They were brought by parents. They didn't really have any choice in
But that's all they know. All they know is the American way.
Which is why before allowing children to receive preferential treatment through the system. The part where I'm really trying to section off is trying to keep distant cousins, you know, my mom's brother's wife,
but
for example.
I'm not saying let the ones come with me, like say it's still my family. I'm not saying let the ones come with me that are already, like, you know, 10, 12, and they've grown up. I'm just talking about have a certain limit to where I can bring babies with me. since I'm gonna be going, of course I'll be making more money over.
Well, I mean, with that same age, you said 12. I mean, usually a 12-year-old is still dependent on parents. You know, they're.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I mean, in other countries they are working, but in America we still view them as, you know, children, as 12-year-olds.
I'm just saying, but it'd be a better. They're trying to have a better situation for these babies. If they're three, that's what I'm saying, 3 years and below.
I feel like we're talking past point. How about I say this? How about with the same chain policy, children are admitted among a parent being accepted? As a parent, when you're accepted, you are allowed to bring your children. Mm-hmm. So does that change the calculus of the system any? I don't feel like it would, because what I was trying to say in my system was, if a 30-year-old male has him and his wife and their three kids, if his wife were to apply and his children, they would all receive preferential treatment to America to sort of assimilate a culture of family values in a way. Mm-hmm. To sort of, because one thing that you have to be careful with is the division of families in this. So that would be something where I'd give preferential treatment if you're establishing a family, you're bringing your wife and kids. Mm-hmm. Now what the problem comes into is your mom's brother's son. When you have cousins and other relatives who may not qualify for the system regularly, but are getting preferential treatment because of the chain rule that you got accepted.
I'm not saying bring grown ass men over here. I'm saying only infants, only babies.
Now a lot of times, would you set a cap for that age too? Because
that's what I was saying.
What would you run set that cap to? Because one thing that you do have to realize when you go to a lot of third world countries is they tend to have families younger and younger. So I mean, a 25-year-old man might have an 8-year-old son. You know, they might have children within a small age pool. So what would you set as a sort of cap age for that?
Who else I can bring? Am I saying who else I can bring, or just my kids personally?
Of someone as an individual. How, like say your parents, I said your parents would be able to come in. Mm-hmm. So if you would set the age cap at 65, in a lot of places that would include grandparents. Mm-hmm. So where do you feel like an age cap should be there? Acknowledging that in third world countries, a lot of families are younger and younger than typical. Mm-hmm. Than a typical first world westernized country. Because I think the average age that a woman has a child in America, I don't know the stats specifically, but I feel like I remember it being around 26, 27 is when a woman has her first child here, mm-hmm. which is about 8 years below the global average in third world countries.
Okay. So your question is this. What's
given that families are younger and younger in third world countries, where would you sort of set an age cap to a point where you aren't letting large swaths of the family in with the age cap?
Look at six and below. Age six and below.
So six and below. So
that's like first grade.
Would you be for giving preferential treatment to, say, like a 9-year-old son or a 10-year-old son? Because, I mean, in America, you would still, a 10-year-old would still be dependent on the parents.
Yeah,
in a lot of ways.
I say, if I'm already bringing my kid, if I'm bringing my kids already, they're 8, 9 years old.
Yeah.
Me and the mother already working, because, of course, kids can't work in America. They can't.
No, 12-year-olds aren't exactly. That's something different about first world countries. 12-year-olds aren't exactly working jobs. And a lot of times, that's what you run into. In a lot of third world countries, is child labor in a lot of ways. 11, 12-year-olds would be, you know, farm hands in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, just as that's a general position. Not all 12-year-olds are field hands, of course. But just saying, you know, that's 12-year-old could be making an income at that point, but we wouldn't have documentation of that income for, say, social programs.
Mm-hmm. I see what you're saying.
So for me personally, I'd be for setting a cap on your children at 17, then they apply. So I'll say after they turn 17, they have to apply individually. Mm-hmm. But younger children that would not be able to assimilate as easier into the workforce, I would say allow them to have preferential treatment through the system.
Okay. That makes logical sense. So if I bring my family over, right? I bring my family. My child gets to a certain age while he's here. You want him to reapply, or is he already good to go?
If you apply before he is 17, he would be able to get preferential treatment. But if you apply after that child would turn 17, I would say yes, he would have to apply individually. So basically, if let's say you apply when your son is 16 and 6 months, if he turns 17 by the time you're accepted, he would receive the same preferential immigration treatment through the policy. But if you apply after he is the age of 17, I would say then he has to file individually. Because at that point, he would be able to come here.
If he has kids in that time frame, do they not get to come as well?
And that's actually a difficult point in the chain rule, because that would be, those technically would be your grandkids. Which I would say yes to, because like I was saying before, if you bring someone through a preference treatment, as long as they're admitted, I believe they do have the right to bring direct family. So your son being admitted, that would be his direct family at that point.
Okay. Now,
And that wouldn't affect your status at all, because you'd be a grandparent at that point. Like I was saying, the grandparents would probably be a cutoff for me personally.
I'm in the country. Yeah, preferential treatment. My family, my son.
Well, no, this is what I was saying. This is for people in the process already.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm in the process.
You're in the process. You're still in the country. You're still in your home country. You're not in the United States. This was actually a policy that wasn't being prescribed. I wasn't speaking of this policy as for people who are already in the country. So this is for people in the process currently of applying to come over.
Okay. Now, let's say I go through the process. I get accepted when we get into the country.
Yes.
I bring my parents, my kids.
Your parents, yes. I was thinking grandparents. Your parents, your wife, and your children.
Okay. Once, at a certain point, when I've been accepted, I'm in the process. Like, not in the process.
You're accepted. You're established
I'm
in the country.
I'm good.
You're in the United States. Now, you're established and accepted.
Once my children become of age, do they have to reapply? I'm just asking, do we have to keep reapplying?
Wait, so you're asking...
No, I keep reapplying. Do we have to keep renewing this?
Okay, so let me just clarify what you're asking. You're saying you are established in the United States.
We're all already established. You have to keep updating our
status. 15-year-old son, you're established in the United States, and you have a 15-year-old son.
Yes.
At 17, would he have to reapply?
Yes.
No, once you're accepted through the system and he's accepted too at 15, you would become citizens.
Okay.
So at that point, he wouldn't have to reapply because he would have already gained citizenship.
Now, let's say... Do we have to keep updating our status?
No, at that point you'd be citizens. You wouldn't have to reply. You'd get full benefits. You wouldn't have to, if you came and got accepted through the system, your son, after he reaches the age I was speaking about, 17, he would be a citizen at that point. He would be good. He wouldn't have to reapply. Mm-hmm. His children would be in the same situation. If he is a citizen and he has his children here and they came through him, and they came with him through the chain rule, mm-hmm. they would be citizens also. I feel like what you're hitting at is the 17-year-old, if you were to be, let's say you were 25 and you have, well, not 25, 7, you can't have kids at 7. If you are 30 and your son is 17, if you got in, if you were accepted while he was 17, mm-hmm. would he have to reapply? He would apply individually in that circumstance because he would be above the age that I was speaking of, the age cap that I was proposing. So you would be accepted. If he's 17 and you're 30 right now, you would be accepted through the system and he would have to apply since he technically would be above that age cap at a certain point. But he would also... I ran into my own dilemma there. He would have to apply individually.
I want to say, yeah, he's applying individually. But would he get some help because I've already been accepted? Or would he be viewed as his own single person? Because he'd still be living in my household at that point.
That's why I'm revolving around the age of 17, is if you apply and he is 17 at the time you apply, mm-hmm. he would have to apply individually.
Okay, so he's applying.
But children that would still be under your household, below 17, when you can start.
That's what I'm asking. Would he get some type of, I want to say benefit, not entirely special treatment, but because I just got accepted.
Yes.
But since he just became of age when I got accepted, would he... I understand he'd have to apply. By himself.
Yeah.
But what he get, I have to say benefit. Benefit of the doubt because...
Let me say this. So, like I was saying, if he is 16 and 6 months when you apply, the age I'm revolving around 17, that starts from the application date, not the acceptance date. So okay. If you apply while he is 16,
okay.
he would be able to come through with chain rule. But if you apply after he is 17 years of age,
okay.
he would have to file as an individual.
Okay. And this is what I'm asking. Say I apply after he's already 17. and he applies as well. I get accepted. Will he get looked at as an individual?
Yes.
Or as part of my family? Because
as an individual, I think he would, at that point he would go above the age cap of the chain of the Durek family chain.
But I'm saying, would it be easier for him to get accepted because he's only been living in my house? And you've already accepted me.
At that point, no, because I see him as an adult in his country. I see him as a participant in the workforce of said country. Mm-hmm. So I'd say he would apply individually, and he wouldn't be able to fall under your chain, under the preference of your chain rule. Mm-hmm. So he would be applying as an, now if he happened to have children at that point, they would fall under his chain rule. But as far as your direct family chain, at 17, no, he would not be able to receive the benefits from your chain. Which I see the problem that I see a problem you're facing here is if you, let's say you have multiple kids, and you have an 18-year-old son, a 13-year-old son, and an 8-year-old son. I'm saying the 13 and the 8-year-old would be able to gain preferential treatment, would more than likely be accepted through the system I'm proposing, but that 18-year-old son would have to apply as an individual.
I understand he's applying as an individual, but would he get a leg up because we've all already been accepted?
No, I think at that point we'd have to see him as
he hasn't lived on his own. Yes. He's 18, but he hasn't lived on his own. He's only lived in my house. So I'm saying, would he get preferable? I think that's the right word. Preferable acceptance over others since he hasn't been doing anything but living in my house and just working with us.
I feel like that's another one of those hard lines we're going to have to set at a certain point in a tamed immigration system. Is at that point he would have to be. You'd have to be looked at as an individual in that case. We would have to look at his application individually and separately from yours. Mm-hmm. Even though that is your, you know, a direct chain from you. Mm-hmm. I feel like at that point we would have to see him as his own individual. Because at some point we're going to have to set a hard age cap if we're going to have a more tamed immigration system.
Mm-hmm. I hear what you're saying. That's hard.
I know, that's what I was saying. It's gonna be at some point you have to have hard lines to be able to have sort of a tamed immigration system. So he would be looked at as an individual. It wouldn't affect your status at all. You would still be accepted and admitted. Your 15 and 13 year old would be accepted and admitted too. But at a certain point we have to set an age at when we start looking at people as individuals.
Because at that point, if we all get accepted, he gets denied because he applied by himself. How is he going to take care of himself? But he's only been working to help me.
I mean, I feel like that's, we run into that same problem in America. There's a lot of 17-year-olds live on their own. A lot of are in bad situations. But I feel like that's going to be a cap we would have to set. And it may be hard. I can only imagine what it would be like for a lot of families. I know personally, a friend, they have had people deported and people sent out before. At a certain point, we have to draw a hard line where we would have to look at you as an individual. Because about 17, 18, you're an adult at 18. Mm-hmm. You would be able to be a thriving person in the workforce. So at that point, I feel like we'd have to separate you off from your sponsor or your direct chain sponsor to view you as an individual.
Okay. But at the same time, that's putting a couple people in poverty. If you never worked, you never live except with your.
Like, at 17, I imagine there'd be some applicable skills to a workforce. Mm-hmm. You have to be 16 or have a permit in America to work. At 17, 18, you would be able to. I'd assume this is under a presumption that you'd have workable skills. And also, one thing that we're sort of skating over this whole thing is a lot of times the age gap, that would disproportionately affect more third world countries and. Yeah. South and Latin America. Now, if you want to talk about more Europe, that's where you start getting more developed systems where, there's a different culture there. Mm-hmm. And that's what, in a way, that's what this is all centered around, is an ideal culture for bringing into a country.
Now, let me play devil's advocate real quick.
Okay, go ahead.
Now, what if this child, let's say I got four children.
Yes.
And two of them are disabled. Would they be exempt from this if they are, let's say, 20?
Are we talking about, let's say you have a child with, very common in a lot of third world countries that don't have medical standards, is you have a child with a birth defect. Mm-hmm. You have a child with Down syndrome or a condition that they aren't able to work.
Do they get an exception? They have to come. They get to come with me.
I do believe that. That I do believe would have to be a stipulation in your application, where you'd have to apply for, maybe we could refer to it as a medical waiver, you know, as a, because I feel like that is a place where, I feel like that is a, you know, individual state's responsibility. I feel like it's a state's responsibility to help those who legitimately cannot help themselves. So you're, just to be 100% clear with you, you're saying, let's say you have, your son is 20, and he has a condition where he needs you as care.
Correct.
I feel like that could be a, that could be a different tab or stipend in your waiver where you apply for medical amnesty or medical waiver to allow him to come.
Now, at the same time, let's say it's not my kid. Let's say...
Well, in the system I'm proposing, if it's not your child, he wouldn't have your chain rule at all. He wouldn't receive preference under your application.
Let's say my niece and nephew live with me, and they have a disability. These are multiple variables on top of variables.
Are their parents in the picture? I would have to factor that in. What's their parents? What's the status of their parents?
Their parents, let's just say their parents are dead.
Okay, so I'm not extending this to biological children.
No, I'm just saying they're forced to live with me.
Yeah, okay, so under that, I'll clear that up. Under the chain rule I was proposing, I'm not cutting that off as biological children. Mm-hmm. So, like, if you have a child where you are the guardian or you are the legal caregiver, you have custody of them, they would get that chain rule.
Okay.
They would be able to receive your preference under the chain system. Now, if they, let's say their parents were alive, let's say they had the ability to live with their parents and you weren't their legal guardian, they would have to apply under their legal guardian's application if they were under the age of 17 or had a disability with a medical waiver.
Okay. I want to say if... Because I'm trying to think of, there are multiple different scenarios for people in the Southern Hemisphere, South America, and stuff like that.
Yes.
There are multiple stuff that they have to deal with and go through. If...
And let me just I know we're being kind of vague with the application process. I feel like we can agree on certain criteria where we can sort of judge a merit-based system. We can judge, you know, education level, applicable skills, years in the workforce in their home country, description of that. Now, I feel like those are common standards. And like we were saying earlier with the preferential for people who are able to speak English, I mean, you would presumably have to test that ability at some point in the application process. So are we under the criteria that those are the merit bases that we would judge on? Just so we can start from a common ground right here, I want to like set out characteristics that we can agree to for the merit-based system. So age, education level, workforce experience, and of course we'd have to include different things like criminal record and all that.
Because at the same time, that, say my son, he turned 17 when I applied, and he's only been working for 3 years.
That would go into his individual application that he was in a workforce for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Because at no point could he be able to take care of himself without me in the picture.
Well, what we're assuming under...
So would that have to be, I stay with him in the country? Let's say I could accept it, but I just send my family...
I feel like what you're going into is a transfer rule, where it's say if you were living with your child, and you get accepted, and your wife, your underage children, under the age of 17 children, and parents, if they're accepted through the system also, do you have the right to defer your acceptance and stay with him in the country?
Just mom.
Now let me think about it for a moment, because that would set up a tricky scenario where you would have been the one accepted.
Correct.
And your dependents and direct lineage would be in the country.
Correct.
So at that point, we wouldn't be letting the person be accepted in the country, but their direct descendants.
Correct.
That
scenario, because that makes it a little harder because you think about too many different
things. Let's
just say I pull up with my family and I'm applying just for them to get accepted.
I feel like that would have to be a stipulation. I feel like that would have to be a scenario where you would have to accept the admission. You would have to come over because you're the primary applicant. You would be the one who was accepted through the system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only reason I allowed the chain rule is because the chain rule is to benefit you. Mm-hmm. It's so if you are to establish yourself in the United States, it would make the transition easier if you were allowed to bring your children, your wife, your parents, etc. If you were to not come into the country, I don't feel like we would, I don't feel like it'd be something to allow them to come in strictly on your admittance if you're not going to come. Because when you would be accepted, that means we would have seen you as a viable person in the workforce. We would believe you could have immense benefits in the American system. And if you weren't to come at that point, I feel like we would have to not allow you. It would really based on whether you come or not. Because we're accepting you. Mm. We're allowing you to come in, and to make your assimilation easier, we would let your family in. Now, if you were to not come and just your family, I feel like that would set up a predicament where, you know, we sort of let them in on a different merit system. We let them in on a system that they were related to you directly, and it would make your assimilation easier. Mm-hmm. But if you weren't to come in, we wouldn't really have to make your assimilation easier because you wouldn't be assimilating. Mm-hmm. So that's honestly why I set the hard age gap. It's because at a certain point, if you get accepted, we're assuming you will come, and we're trying to make it easier for you to become established. If you weren't going to become established, I feel like we would have to consider that on your applicants being accepted.
What if there's certain people I can select to stay and go?
Do
I get that choice?
I feel like that would not be your choice. I feel like that would have to be your immigration advisor's choice.
Bring it back to my son. He might need other people to stay with him to help him. Can I not pick and choose who gets to come with me? He said...
Well, when you say come with you, you wouldn't be coming. You'd be staying in your home country.
So
they wouldn't be coming with you. They would just be coming without you, which sets up the predicament where you were accepted and they weren't.
Say I go in and I bring such and such with me. Do I get to pick and choose who gets to come with me if I come into the country?
You would be allowed to pick, again, anybody who is your direct family, your parents, your children, and siblings.
At that point, since I'm already accepted, and I can pick and choose who comes and who stays.
Well, you'd only get to pick from that select pool. You wouldn't be able to just pick.
From that pool.
So that select pool.
Once, let's say I'm already in the country.
You're established in the United States.
I got four kids. Three came with me and my wife.
And your wife.
Yeah.
She would be allowed.
And my grandparents, they stayed.
Not your grandparents, your parents.
Yeah, my parents, they stayed.
Yes.
Because they're helping the other son. Since I'm already in the country and I've already been accepted, of course, my parents would stay to help him work until he can apply himself. Do they just get to come?
So you're saying
they have to reapply?
I feel like, so if they were to come at a later date, if you were to come to the country and then maybe 3 years later, your parents want to come also.
Like they're ready to go.
Yes, I think that would be allowed under the chain rule I'm explaining, because that would still be your direct, they'd still be your direct family. Mm-hmm. So yes, they would be able to come. Even if they had to come later, I feel like if you are accepted and you're established in the country, even if they come at a later date, you would be able to sponsor them and they'd be able to get your chain preference.
Okay.
So if you and your wife and two of your kids come and your parents stay back and are taking care of your third son.
Now.
Then yes, I feel like your parents could come at a later date.
What about, I get accepted, right? I got my wife, my kids, my parents, everybody good to go. What about my wife's parents?
That's another situation of a transfer. I feel like they would have to apply individually since she did not get admitted through a merit system. She got admitted through the chain system. Because right now what we're talking about is a merit system for the individual who applies and then the chain system for direct family. I don't feel like you can have a chain on top of a chain. So if you came in through the chain program, I would not say you'd get a preference chain.
What if, because of course you're going to have blended families,
something I actually want to hit on. Like you were saying with your parents, if they take care of your son, technically under that rule, they would be the legal guardians of that son. Mm-hmm. But I feel like we'd have to take that into consideration where it was you gave up custody of your son to your parents. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that would be something where that technically wouldn't be their child, because that would be their grandchild. But I feel like the child would not get their chain either, because that would be another situation where you have someone who came in on a preference chain, on a direct family chain. I don't feel like he would be able to be extended that same favor. So that'd be two family chains in the same application. This is definitely not an easy topic to talk about. So here we're gonna go to a different group of people now. Also earlier in the Trump administration, they're proposing a ban on immigration from a lot of Middle Eastern countries, mm-hmm. from seven specific countries that they identified as state sponsors of terror: Saudi Arabia, Yemen, mm-hmm. Pakistan. I don't think Afghanistan or Iraq were on the list, but Iran was. How do you feel about that policy?
I feel like that is a discriminatory policy on the basis that it is primarily only targeting Muslim countries, because he said he prefer we pull from countries that are more Christian or
More westernized countries, usually Protestantism and Catholicism.
I feel like that's discriminatory against a certain religion.
Now, from a national security standpoint, do you feel like it would be better? Do you feel like it's okay to discriminate on that on a national security standpoint? Because something that happened.
I don't feel like it's fair to discriminate against a religion.
Well, because one thing that happened in 2016 is when ISIS was at its peak, they seized a lot of government buildings, and that government building had the ability to make passports. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure you can see the dangerous predicament it can be when you have migrants coming through that are able to make passports from a group like that.
I see it as this. All right, ISIS controlled territory in Iraq, correct?
Yes.
Then I feel there should just be a suspension on passports from Iraq until we have ISIS under control.
Well, a lot of things with that is centering around the policy was designed around ideology. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't have to necessarily be in Iraq or Syria to have that ideology. Mm-hmm. You know, you can be in Saudi Arabia and still have the same ideology as they would in Iraq and Syria. Mm-hmm. So from a national security standpoint, do you feel like it, I wouldn't say is the responsibility of the federal government, but do you believe it would be a cautious step in protecting homeland citizens from possibly people infiltrating that system with bad intentions? And also because a lot of the migrants that come from the Middle Eastern countries, that's where the debate of refugees or economic migrants really come into play, is if you're going to assign refugees asylum to eventually go back, or if they are coming over to set up an economic base in the country to eventually bring in other members.
Mm-hmm. Now,
because I mean, all aside, I feel like we have to recognize that there is a specific ideology in that region of the world that has done horrible things.
But that's not to say.
Not to say everybody is. But I feel like, do you think it's a viable prevention mechanism from people with said ideology coming into American homeland?
Because I feel like just because you have a tree and the whole tree thinks the same, just because you got a couple bad apples doesn't mean all the other apples are spoiled.
No, but think of it.
But just because they all think the same don't mean they all have the same intentions.
Of course, but you do understand that it would sort of be more difficult to tease out. Because one thing that you can tease out in immigration applicants is, like I was saying, those key variables we can see on merit. We can see age, work experience, education level, and that. It's really hard to tease out ideology in an applicant.
I don't feel religion should be included in that criteria, because that's discriminatory. You're not letting me do something because of what I believe in, whether...
I do agree with you that it is discriminatory to say if you are a Muslim, you are not allowed to immigrate here. But you also have to take into account that you're not going to be able to know that about everybody who's applying. You know, that's something that you really can't tease out on the application. So is it, I agree it's discriminatory, but do you feel like it's a viable national security step to have that? Can you explain?
I don't think so, because as soon as you start discriminating based on religion, you're going against our own constitution and our beliefs. Our belief is that you should be allowed to
to believe what you want to believe when you come into this country.
I'm not saying
you can't give constitutional rights to people who are not from this, who are not here, who are not citizens. But I'm saying if you believe in our constitution and what we believe is our ideology is that you not discriminate against someone because of what they believe.
Against citizens. I feel
like that should be included on the application. They shouldn't ask you what religion do you believe in.
Well, that's a big basis is under the Establishment Clause, you know, someone living in Pakistan won't have that constitutional right. They won't be protected under the Establishment Clause. So given that they wouldn't be protected under the Establishment Clause, and also mainly the purpose of the policy was a national security threat. Because in 2016, I think there was 452 suicide bombings within the Middle Eastern region, and about 450 have been traced to state-sponsored terror or religious terror. So I feel like, do you think as a national security standpoint, regional discrimination, because of course, that's what we base it off. We base it off of the region that have high concentrations of that religion.
I feel like it's better that we know, like if you want to take it to a national security standpoint, all right, say you let such and such in or such and such people in because they are, for the purpose of the argument, these people believe in Islam.
Yeah.
And they come in, like you let them in, this, that, and the third, and you know, they keep studying Islam, they're no problem. Whereas the way to get around that discrimination is all the people would have to just say, oh, they've converted and they've become Christians.
Well, that's the thing, we wouldn't be able to honestly be able to get a straight answer on that in a lot of applications. I mean, you could say you're one thing on your application, because I mean that goes into a whole different case of application fraud, which there's really no way to pin down the ideology of someone. Mm-hmm. That's completely unquantifiable.
But to put a certain ideology on a whole group of people when the vast majority of people don't believe that ideology, that's discriminatory.
Well, I mean, it's a large majority. It's about 85% of the Middle East practices Islam.
Yes, they practice Islam. But I'm saying, when I'm saying ideology, I mean, not a lot of them have that violent or somewhat radical ideology. A lot of them are, as we are, they're in the middle. They just live their lives. They just practice their religion and keep it moving. Whereas the other ones who have political goals, they are usually on the radical, violent side, trying to prove a point.
Exactly. But going on that same standpoint is, with that policy, do you believe that there should be a safeguard in the way? I mean, you can, if you have a bad feeling about something, you can do a match to prevent it. So do you feel like, as a national security point, do you feel like that's a rational way to act as a safeguard against that potentially coming to your own? So, because you, as the federal government, does have a, you know, they have a moral obligation to protect its citizens. You know, so you'd have to take that into account as when you're doing any migrant from the Middle East, from Southern America, is are they going to pose any sort of threat to your established citizens?
Mm-hmm. I understand. Me personally, if I was in the shoes, I would not ban the people from these countries. Like I said, I would.
I can't even say suspend. Let's say not ban. How would you test ideology?
You can't test ideology.
So do you believe, since you can't test ideology, maybe this is a viable safeguard against? Because it only takes one. I mean, it's sort of like saying, you know, you don't know until they get here. But I mean, if I've had one bad apple, it doesn't spoil the rest of the trees. But if you weren't able to know that apple's bad until you bit into it, would it be a safeguard to say, I'm not going to eat from this tree?
But how would you ever know?
That's the thing. That's why I was saying. Do you think the band is
so
takes a solid safeguard step in preventing the possibility of that coming?
That's to assume you just walk up to the tree and assume it's bad.
Well, I mean, there's viable evidence that a region is bad.
The viable evidence that a certain group of people in that region are bad. That's not to assume that entire region is bad.
No, but again, like I said, it could be one bad apple, but you won't know until you get here.
It's just a risk that you take. We take that risk every single day when we let in anybody from anywhere. If they have a different ideology,
I mean, you can concentrate you can largely concentrate ideology. Like you were saying, it's not like it's a mystery where in the world this is coming from. Mm-hmm. There's a specific region of the world that poses a specific threat. It's not like we're not sure if they're coming from China or mm-hmm. Norway or Chile or Brazil.